Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we're going to learn about how probiotics dramatically modulate liver cancer growth, University of Hong Kong, and how something as simple as raspberries can make an enormous difference on antiviral, antimicrobial, anti-cancer properties in the body. But, and here's the key, it's all in their bioavailability. And when I read this study, I thought, well, that harkens back to a study I did a long time ago at the beginning of my career, where, as chance would have it, my senior editor, my publishing company, had terminal cancer. I didn't know it. And in fact, it was only when I found out she was in a hospital that I was affiliated with. I was in the research division of an institute that was affiliated with a hospital, and I saw her there. And then she told me she didn't want people to know it. And I tried something. And what I tried made an enormous difference. And that's how I went into the whole area of bioavailability. So this touched a point in my own life. And when I'm talking about helping people today and the tens of thousands of people I've helped one-on-one, and for those who are able to get better, improve, or in some cases reverse their condition, it's all about understanding how to get the maximum amount of healing energy into the actual cell. So I'll talk about that. I think you'll find that of interest. Also today, we're going to have a little shorter time on health because I've got a lot coming up on new information that no one in this audience has heard on the JFK assassination. We will be speaking about the medical evidence behind the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. William Mattson Law has been researching the assassination of John F. Kennedy for over 25 years, and his research has appeared in over 30 books, including Douglas Horne's magnum opus, Inside the Assassination Records Review. Law was the producer of the award-winning documentary RFK, and also he was the writer, director, producer of the film The Gathering, and served as a consultant to the director, Brian McKenna, for his theatrical film Killing Kennedy. He will be joined by Jim Jenkins down in Alabama. Jim is in the military at the time of the JFK assassination and participated throughout the Kennedy autopsy in Bethesda Naval Hospital. Very few people, if anyone else, is alive today who worked on that autopsy. So this is really interesting what he has to say. And they'll be joined by Hugh Clark. And Hugh was a member of the Naval Honor Guard that escorted President Kennedy's body in the Arlington Cemetery for burial. He also served as an investigator for the United Nations and also served as a director of alcohol and substance abuse residences to his retirement in 2008. So these three men will share insights you have not heard to give us another part of the picture, and that's something we benefit from. Again, this will be exclusive, and I've done, I guess, about 100 unique and different programs on the subject of John F. Kennedy's assassination. But this is going to have some unique, original, outstanding, first person, not hearsay, evidence presented to you that'll take up the remainder of the program. Probiotics. Well, we know what they are. We get them when we have fermented foods, everything from non-dairy and dairy fermented kefirs and yogurts, to sauerkraut, kimchi, miso. There are many different sources. They're all good. These are called probiotics, and they impact the intestinal bacteria. We have thousands and thousands of different types of bacteria. To make it really simple, when we eat good foods and good juices, clean, healthy foods, we produce more good, healthy bacteria that in turn cause a reaction in our brain, in our central nervous system, or overall health. This is from the University of Hong Kong, and this was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Quote, medical research over the last decade has revealed the effects of the gut microbiome across the range of health markers, including inflammation, immune response, metabolic function, and weight. There's a corresponding interest in probiotics as a therapeutic approach to many illnesses affecting our health by our gut bacteria. Previous studies have demonstrated the beneficial role of probiotics in reducing gastrointestinal inflammation and preventing colorectal cancer. But a new study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science explored their immunomodulatory effects on extraintestinal tumors, specifically the carcinoma, the HCC. And what they found was this, and it gets a little technical, so I'll just give it to you in lay language, that in this laboratory experiment, when they gave healthy, good bacteria, it was able to substantially impact, in a good way, the liver cancer. In other words, it kept the liver cancer from growing. Now, here's the idea, and this is where I both support and commend science for doing this study, but I also offer a challenge in that virtually all of science is monotheistic, meaning it takes a single point of view, a single reference, and it takes it out of the larger context. For example, well, we studied this chemical and we found it does not cause cancer. But that chemical is only one of 11 others used in vaccines. So did you study it in relationship with the other 10? No. How can you say then it's safe, since in life almost everything is synergistic? You might say that the meat that you analyzed in a particular hot dog, you could not find causes cancer, but did you cook the meat? No. Did you look at the dye that used the meat, the sodium nitrite? No. Did you examine the heterocyclic amines when something is charcoal broiled or heated at a high temperature, how it changes the proteins and it then becomes carcinogenic? No. Did you study the bun, which is high in gluten and acrylamides, from the browning process? No. So then how can you give people the impression that having a hot dog is safe from cancer when you have not looked at all the other compounding issues involved eating a hot dog or a hamburger or anything else? That's the monotheistic. So they will do a research showing, and doing it well, showing that, for example, that by taking probiotics, it will dramatically modulate liver cancer growth. And they'll publish it in America's most prestigious journal, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. But will they then assume that it might also work for cancer of the colon? No. The brain, liver, lungs, breast, prostate, stomach? No. Why not? If it works in one medium, why wouldn't it work in another medium? Because we didn't do the research. This is this mind-numbing limitation of virtually all, 100% of all science. It does not look at the larger context in which a person lives. And this is part of the downside of these studies. When you look at a study and you say, well, a person drank 2 glasses of alcohol a day and didn't have a heart attack. What kind of alcohol? What percentage of alcohol? What else was occurring in their life? What else did they do? Did they smoke? Did they drink? Did they exercise? Did they have sugar? None of this are they really measuring. So that's why any study to have value, in my personal opinion, must be multidimensional. It must take into account, as best as possible, everything else that could be impacting a person, and therefore include that into the final analysis. But still, the good news is that probiotics helped you. So my reasoning is, if probiotics help modulate liver cancer, probiotics would help modulate colorectal cancer, stomach cancer, and other cancers in the body. Also, and this seems like such a simple little issue, and it's, I guess for many it would be, bioavailability crucial for raspberry health benefits. All right, bioavailability. That means when you consume something, how much of what you consumed actually gets used by the cell. In this case, this is from Prevent Disease, and here is what they're saying. And this was published, and I'll read the first part of it here. Berry benefits. Bioavailability was found to differ at different locations of the gastrointestinal tract. This latest research further illustrates the complex metabolism of raspberry phytochemicals and the location of absorption. The small intestine and the colon play a critical role in the bioavailability of both anthocyanins and ergotamines. And it says, food scientists from Spain, Italy, and the United Kingdom focused their research on specifically the bioavailability of raspberry anthocyanins. The study sought to show how these phytochemicals were metabolized by the body once ingested. And they consumed 300 grams. To give you an idea, it's 20.35 grams to an ounce. So that would be about 9 ounces of raspberries. And then they examined the blood and urine samples for 24 hours. And they found that, gee whiz, the polyphenols in the red raspberries are very good for you. And the body metabolizes these micronutrients, and then they help you in different ways. There's anti-inflammatory, meaning it turns off inflammation. That's good for arthritis and bursitis and ileitis and pain. Both the black and red berries are good for anti-cancer, and they're anti-neurodegenerative, meaning they actually help turn off a degeneration in the brain. They help protect your brain and central nervous system longer. So by any measure, the idea is eat your raspberries, black or red, and you'll be healthier. But it doesn't end there. Now let's take a trip back in time. I was a registered dietitian. I had my degree, undergraduate degree at that time in clinical nutrition. And I was a nutritionist. And I was a junior scientist at the Institute of Applied Biology. Across the street was a hospital that we were affiliated with. And purely by coincidence, one day I was over there talking with the director about a particular project I wanted to do, that we were also assigned by the city of New York to help people if they didn't want to go to jail, they could get drug treatments. And I believe that the method that was being used at the time, methadone, was inferior. I believed in a holistic approach. And I was working with Dr. Lane Kahn, who was a longtime associate, and we had come up with a program of combining, of changing their biochemistry to break the physical chemical addiction, but also psychological and behavioral. So it was a really holistic plan, and we were trying to get it implemented. And at the hospital, and lo and behold, I'm walking by a room, and I stop, and there's someone that I knew very well. She was my editor, and a wonderful editor, just one of the best editors I've ever had. So I talk, and she had end-stage cancer. In effect, she was now using the hospital as hospice care. She did not intend to make it out, and she left her job quietly. And something occurred to me. I'm looking at the food that was on her plate, and everything on that food actually either caused cancer or destroyed the immune system. So I asked permission from her if I could work with the physician in creating a different diet for her. And she said, fine, nothing to lose, right? Going to die anyhow. And it wasn't quite that simple, because some of these doctors don't have any respect for dietitians, because the dietitian has no authority, no control. They simply have to take the diet that is directed and prescribed by the physician and implement it through the different food services, the hospital. And if you know anything about dietetic training, it is not healthy you can become a holistic dietitian, but you're not going to do it in any school. You have to do it on your own. In any case, I got the director of the hospital to agree to this. And then I was using some experiments, and it was all about not feeding the mice who had cancer water. No water at all. I would give them fresh-made juices that I would make every day. Wheatgrass juice, for example, and other juices. Many of the juices that I recommend people have today. And what is juice? 97% or 98% of juice is water. Now, we need water. Water is our single largest macronutrient. About 72 to 74% of every tissue in the body is water. And that in itself is important, clean, healthy water. But it's what's in the juice that's at that 2 to 3% that's what's healing and restorative and repairs the DNA. And those are the phytonutrients, the chlorophylls, the fibers. So, yes, eating an apple is very important, and we should. Having some apple juice is also important, and you're actually getting more healing nutrients out of the juice than you are out of the apple. Now, if you dried the apple, it's still good, and you're still getting nutrients. But if you wicked off the water, what you're left with is what is the most single concentrated amount of what heals. And I was doing a lot of research on drying juices and then taking the powders and using them in laboratory studies. So I tried them with her. And the first thing we noticed after about 3 or 4 or 5 days is her energy picked up. The color in her skin came back. Pain that she had had subsided substantially. And first the doctor thought it was just a placebo effect, you know, trying something new. Someone who knows her is there. And she didn't want people seeing her in her debilitated state. Most people don't. But it was more than that. And I had a discussion at that time with the director of the institute, not the director of the hospital, but the institute. And I said, I believe that we're making an enormous error in all of health. We are looking at the macro consumption instead of the micro bioavailability and absorption. And I gave him example after example after example. And I said, now, upstairs on the third floor, you have two sets of rats. One are getting standard rat chow. The other are getting a completely organic, healthy diet with lots of compounding powders. And they're doing incredibly well. And because none of the other scientists were interested in this at all, they were all looking for the gold ring of having the next chemotherapy agent or the next tranquilizer. I mean, they were all ultra-orthodox scientists. I was the odd one out. And hence, I was given no respect and no attention. They didn't believe that there was any relationship between diet and disease. None. Outside of mass starvation, kwashiorkor, that's all they knew. If you were eating the average American diet, it didn't matter if you ate potato chips or took teaspoons of sugar. A calorie is a calorie. I mean, you talk about limited. They were extraordinarily limited. So anyhow, I said, will you watch for yourself, no one else, and watch the difference in hair growth coming back? And there was this something he worked with me on. Some of the scientists were doing, trying to get this healing cream, this chemical they could patent for radiation burns. So all these animals had radiation burns, and none of them healed, none of them worked. So they would kill these animals. They'd suffocate them. And I was, no matter what I said to oppose this, it didn't mean anything. They didn't care, and I had no authority. So I would take those rats at night, after everyone gone, that they were going to gas, and I would take them upstairs. And I'd just mark across the card an X. That meant that they had been killed. But they hadn't. I saved over 1,000 of those rats that were going to die, and I took them upstairs, and I started using everything I knew, and then trying all kinds of experiments using different types of natural oils. And I remember just massaging different oils, like at that time, coconut oil, massaging coconut oil and whole leaf aloe vera gel, and just the massaging into the burn. You'd see the animal relax. You could feel the musculature relax and until they look forward to getting that massage, that attention each day. but also I started to see healing occurring. And so I told the director, I said, take a look at this. And he looked at it, he said, well, this is interesting. He said, not enough to make any judgment on, but it's interesting. I said, but why don't you take a look at that woman across the street at the hospital? Because everything I'm doing for these rats, I'm doing for her. I'm increasing the bioavailability, the absorption of all the nutrients, because when you have cancer and your cancer's metastasized, there's especially in your stomach and internal organs, in your liver, you can't metabolize a lot. So they're generally fed intravenous, and they're given a tube, and it's a liquid. In my personal opinion, it's just garbage. And actually, in my personal opinion, enhances the death rate. So I said, she's able to absorb an enormous amount of nutrition by making it from a juice into a powder and then reconstituting it as a high-level concentrate, and look at the absorption. Check to see in the nitrogen balance if she's passing this or the body's using it. And more and more vitamin C. And that's where I first came across the idea that the body, when it's sick, can take an enormous amount of vitamin C before it spills any into the urine. And that's where I came up with these original ideas. So the outcome was that this woman, within 2 months, was healthy enough to go home. She still had cancer, but it wasn't stage 4 and it wasn't terminal. And it wasn't because I was sitting there and talking with her and holding her hand. And it was because maximizing immune stimulation at the same time, using nutrients from foods, a plant-based foods, to rebuild the cells and therefore have natural anti-cancer properties. And as this study in the National Academy of Sciences shows, quote, right here, it says that raspberries, antioxidants, anti-cancer. So, imagine how many raspberries could you eat? A pint? You're going to be full. But juice a pint, and how much juice do you get? Like two tablespoons? Now, take the water out of those 2 tablespoons, and how much do you get? It's like 1/8 of a teaspoon. What if you gave 10 tablespoons of that back into the body? That's equivalent to giving at least 30 to 40 pints of raspberries. But the actual healing part, and that's the science that no one's paid attention to. I mean, it's virtually non-existent. And if people want to know how come so many people I work with gets so much better, it's all about concentrating bioavailability of nutrients, bypassing limitations in digestion, enhancing immunity. So it doesn't matter what you eat if you can't digest it. It doesn't matter what you digest if you can't absorb it. It doesn't matter what you absorb if you can't utilize it. It doesn't matter what you utilize if you can't eliminate it. You have to honor each part of that process: digestion, absorption, utilization, and elimination. And it all has to be pure and healing. And when it is, then you've made a difference to yourself. A simple principle coming from that. And finally, just wanted to let people know that 1 in 3 adults don't get enough sleep. This is from the Sleep Review, the Journal of Sleep Specialties. And it says, quote, more than a third of American adults are not getting enough sleep on a regular basis. And that's according to CDC Morbidity and Mortality Weekly. This study documents estimates of self-reported healthy sleep duration in all 50 states. And it says the American Academy of Sleep Medicine and the Sleep Research Society recommends that adults ages 18 to 60 get at least 7 hours each night to promote optimal health and well-being. Sleeping less than 7 hours a day is associated with an increased risk of developing chronic conditions such as obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, stroke, and frequent mental distress. Yes and no. Yes, if you're the average person. No, if you've gone through a detoxification and rejuvenation, you actually will sleep less, but you'll be healthier and more restored. It isn't just sleep, it's the whole purpose of sleep, restoration, detoxification, cleansing, allowing the body's dead cells, bacteria, and indigestible fibers to be eliminated from the body, and at the same time, have restoration of the mitochondria. And that is not what we're paying attention to. So instead of doing a study that is meaningful, and I'm not saying this is not meaningful, it's just information, but a meaningful study would say, what causes the average person not to sleep well? Well, they're eating at night, yes. They're having caffeine in some form at night, yes. They're talking on cell phones, which overstimulate chromosomes, yes. They're around computers, yes. They're around television sets with electromagnetic pulses, yes. They have digital clocks nearby, yes. They don't have dark in the room, yes. They're thinking about problems when they go to bed, which keeps the brain into an anabolic state, yes. So why not then show the problems and then show the solutions and then show what happens when you start healing the body, getting deeper, more restorative sleep, and rejuvenating the brain and the body while you're actually sleeping. If every American took a cayenne heat unit, about 40,000 heat units, one capsule, tocotrienols, about 200 units, mixed tocopherols, about 800 units, coenzyme Q10 ubiquinone at a high bioavailability at about 200 units, calcium and magnesium from citrate at about 800 units, milligrams, vitamin C with quercetin, 1,000 milligrams quercetin and 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C, and before they went to bed, I'm willing to guesstimate that you would reduce overnight heart attacks and strokes by about 90%. And since most heart attacks and strokes happen when people are sleeping, think of how we could save lives, reduce suffering by something that simple. Yet that's not the science they'll do. But it's what I'm sharing with you. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a quick break and come back with our guest. Please stay with us.
Woman and everything you own. All that is plainly states that chances go around. But if you want to know the truth about it, I tell you what's true to you.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, out on the road doing a lot of work. You'll see the results of my work when I return in about a month and a half. I'll be premiering a new feature film, and then 3 months later I'll be premiering another feature film, and 3 months later I'll be premiering another feature film, three new feature documentaries, all on important social issues. And also, over the next 2 days, just from our, we're carried all over the world, and we're also carried on stations all across the United States. Our sister station in New York, where I've been for 39 years, is in a fund drive, and we fully support that. But they have preempted us tomorrow and the next day. They have a Women's Day of programming, and then they have one of their favorite programs from KPFK on Friday. And I want to thank Andrea Katz for at least being the first person to let us know that we would be preempted this week. So I'm hopeful that people will continue to listen at noon to our sister station, New York, and support the station. If, however, you want to hear my original broadcasting tomorrow and Friday, where we have a brand new in-depth investigative report, I'll be doing both days, plus playing some uniquely interesting, insightful commentaries. I'm going to do a commentary tomorrow on America's addiction to violence. I'm also going to do a commentary on the media misleading the public on Syria from the Boston Globe, Stephen Kinzer. I'm going to do a commentary on Thanks for Destroying Our Country. Angry Libyans lash out at Obama's independence. Congratulations. I'm going to do a commentary on It's Time to Stop Supporting Our Troops. 30 million people killed by U.S. since the end of World War II. It doesn't mean you should not support individual soldiers. It means that the wars that these soldiers engage in, we should stop supporting. That all candidates, currently except for Jill Stein, support. So we have a lot to share. So that's the latest. Now, you can listen over the next 2 days at noon over the telephone. Let me give you that phone number. Please write it down. 712-775-6850. 712-775-6850. Or you can listen on the internet at progressiveradionetwork.com or prm.fm. And a lot of people do. But of course, I'm also hopeful that you will support, if you live in New York, support our local station. You've not heard me pitching during this entire fund drive because I was asked not to, without explanation. And I respect that. My views have been that I'm always there to help that station, have been for 39 years. I've raised over $47 million for it. But I also believe, and it's just my belief, that we should also honor all pledges, that if someone trusts that they're going to get a premium, whatever that premium is, that we should send it out within 30 days or sooner. And I fully support that. But we know the reality. Now let's go to my guest standing by. We have three guests, William Mattson Law, Jim Jenkins, and Hugh Clark. And William, I gave your background a little earlier. I'd like to welcome you to this program.
Thank you very much.
We're going to start with you. We're going to start with you, and then we're going to go Jim Jenkins and Hugh Clark. This is a special in-depth investigative report because you all have something in common. You have new and important pieces of the puzzle to allow us to better understand what happened and did not happen involving the JFK assassination. And women, you have conducted some of the most extensive research in the assassination of John F. Kennedy in recent years. And while there's a great deal of material published that deals with events on the ground in Dallas on November 22, 1963, we hear less about what was taking place in the halls of Washington and almost nothing about the medical evidence to reconstruct the assassination. There's a lot of theories about the gunshots, the even wilder theories about whose body was autopsied. However, you've conducted interviews with many individuals who were either present during the autopsy or were involved in the JFK bodies arriving and leaving the Bethesda Naval Hospital. And Jim Jenkins also with us, who was present through the autopsy as an autopsy technician. But I feel we should first begin with the official Warren Commission report, because some people in this audience may not be aware of it, particularly Arlen Specter's single bullet theory that he presented to the commission while he was a young staff attorney. And of course, this theory is the entire basis for the official conclusion that JFK was killed by Lee Harvey Oswald as a lone assassin. So please begin by explaining to us about the medical evidence the commission relied upon for its final report and the report's explanation. In other words, what was the medical evidence only provided to the Specter and others that was presented to the commission? And second, what was ultimately responsible or who was responsible in charge for this medical examination being provided to the commission?
Well, that would be... let's go back to the drawings that were made by the artist Harold Rydberg. I interviewed Harold about 2001. He was about 22 years old at that point, and he told me they used him because he could be controlled. The information that was given to the Warren Commission Rydberg was told to go into a room to bring his boards, meaning things that you draw on, canvases and things like that, and given verbal descriptions by Humes and Boswell of the president's wounds. He was not allowed to look at any pictures. He wasn't allowed to look at anything. He just had to do these drawings according to Humes and Boswell's description. Of course, they moved the back wound up into the neck to fit the single bullet theory. He did these on a Friday, and they were presented to the Warren Commission on a Monday.
Okay, continue.
Well, what else do you want to know as far as that goes?
Well, that, now you've told us that, but I need to know now what you have discovered that would challenge everything that we were told officially.
Well, what I've discovered is I interviewed several people that were there, as you've said. I became really interested in this after reading a book about the assassination, and it became so intriguing to me that I tracked a lot of these people down. And I guess we should, I had interviewed Paul O'Connor. The first person I interviewed was Gerald Custer. I met with him at his home in Pittsburgh, and I spent 3 days with him. And he told me that upon questioning him, I said, "What do you think happened to President Kennedy?" And he said, "I think he was killed by a CIA hit squad." It was extremely strange to hear that. It was very exciting, but he was adamant that there had been something going on with the president when they got the body. I then interviewed sometime later Jim Jenkins. He told me the same thing, and he'll tell you in his own words that he felt that the body had been examined before they ever got it at Bethesda. I managed for the first time to get, there were two men that were assigned to stay with the president's body, and that were the two FBI agents, Francis X. O'Neill and James Seibert. I came and interviewed Seibert through a set of circumstances that you can read about in the book I did. I'm the only one that got to be in his house. I went down to Florida and had a session with him. I've had three sessions with him, and he told me that since we're talking about Spectre, Spectre is the one that came up with the single bullet theory, that one bullet goes through two men causing seven wounds and coming out basically pristine. And Seibert told me quite angrily, he said, the single bullet theory did not happen. His partner, Francis X. O'Neill, told me the same thing, and they both used the same words, although I interviewed them separately. The single bullet theory did not happen. Seibert said that wound in the back was too low to come out his throat and go in the back of his neck and come out his throat. So there's confirmation from two trained experts in the FBI.
What else did they tell you?
The single bullet theory did not happen. If you don't have the single bullet theory, you've got two assassins, at least.
What else did they tell you?
Well, it's easier to start with trying to contact these guys was not easy. I had to talk, when I first interviewed Seibert, tried to talk to Seibert, they have five and a half pages of notes, Federal Document 302. In this document, they wrote down there has been apparent tracheotomy performed as well as surgery of the head area, namely in the top of the skull. So I wanted to ask him about this. So through a series of events, I finally got to talk to him about this. And he said they put that in there because one of the doctors, they were listening to the doctors in the morgue room, and they were taking notes. And one of the doctors said, there's been surgery of the head area. Now, there's been controversy about this, but even Frank O'Neill, who wrote a book called A Fox Amongst Wolves, sent me his unpublished chapter at the time, although he denied that there had been surgery of the head area. He himself wrote that there had been some apparent removal of tissue or cutting of hair on the president's head. Now, that was never done in Dallas, Texas. There was no surgery at all done in Dallas, just enough to put Ringer's lactate in his body, and they made two slits, they said, on either side to put in electrodes to try to start his heart. So the wounds in Dallas, the head wound was about the size of an orange. The wound in his throat that they had assumed at first to be a bullet wound was a small pencil, round as a pencil. Dr. Perry, Malcolm Perry, made a slit across this to insert a trachea tube. And then after the president had expired, they put him, they wrapped him up in sheets, put him in a 400-pound Britannia casket, took it out to Air Force One, where it was placed aboard an airplane. Now, by the time the body is seen again in Bethesda at the morgue, the wound to the head now encompasses the back, the right side, and the top of the head. It had been it was four times larger than as seen in Dallas, and the throat wound, as seen in Dallas, pencil-shaped, about the size of the end of your little finger, is now a wide, gaping, open gash. And this points to someone having gotten to the body, we think, to probe it for bullets, change the wounds, and that's quite evident from the people that I've talked to. I don't take things on reading it. I had to find out for myself what these people thought, and I got more than I bargained for.
Hmm. I appreciate those insights. Please hold on, because we want to go over now and say hello to Jim Jenkins down in Alabama. Jim was in the military at the time of the JFK assassination and participated throughout the Kennedy autopsy at the Bethesda Naval Hospital as an autopsy technician. Jim, by the way, also has degrees in clinical pathology and combined clinical sciences. Nice to have you with us today, Jim.
It's nice to be here.
Jim, there are a few people still alive today who had firsthand experience with the JFK autopsy. Besides yourself, I'm not sure who else there is. We heard what the official report states, so please take your time and describe what you witnessed firsthand, as well as what was discussed and spoken about in your presence while the autopsy was being performed. And there are several inconsistencies that need to be addressed. For example, was there a prior autopsy or invasive investigation done at Parkland Hospital where JFK's body was first taken and prior to the official autopsy conducted in Bethesda that you participated in? And what was the condition of the body when it arrived in the autopsy area you worked in? Could you address these, please?
Yes. I first got involved with this over with one of the researchers. I traveled to Dallas to meet with the Dallas doctors. I was particularly impressed with Dr. McClellan and his description of the wound. As we received the president's body in Bethesda, the wounds were drastically different, particularly the head wound. Dr. McClellan had described it as being in the occipital parietal, possibly a small portion of the temporal area in the back of the head. What we saw in Bethesda was a larger deficit, which was later described as being about 130, 140 centimeters, which were somewhere around five and a half inches. As we reflected the scalp and actually looked at the fracture lines of the skull, the exit wound, or as what I've seen as the exit wound, appeared to be about 2.5 inches by maybe 1.75, certainly no more than 3 by 2. And the remainder of the deficit in the scalp was actually seemed to have been in relation to what the missiles created as it traveled through the skull. The next thing I'd like to address is one of the statements that was made at the autopsy. As Dr. Humes was unwrapping the head and began to examine it, he asked the gallery, which at that time I was not aware of who it was, but it apparently was Dr. Berkeley, who was the president's personal physician, if there had been any surgery done in Dallas. And he was told no, that there had been no surgery. What he was referring to was the scalp. Some of the tear lines in the scalp looked as if they had been extended by a sharp instrument or a scalpel. And certainly as we proceed with the autopsy, this was subsequently how the brain was removed from the skull without doing a normal skull cap with a striker saw and so forth. That apparently was the statement that the two FBI agents overheard and had written in their report. The other controversial wound is the wound in the throat area. Dr. Perry described that as a small, neat wound, approximately 2 to 3 millimeters. When we received it in Bethesda, it was almost 25 millimeters or 25 to 30 millimeters wide. It was rather ragged, and we were told actually that it was a tracheotomy that was performed in Dallas. Once I talked to Dr. Perry, Dr. Perry says that he saw a small entry wound there in the front. This made me believe that possibly the body had been examined rather hurriedly before we received it, and consequently, since we found no large fragments or bullets in the body during the autopsy, that was pretty much confirmation of my feeling, at least for myself.
All right. Well, let's try to understand this then, in lay language, because we have some people in the audience who may not fully appreciate what you just said. There's the question of reporting discrepancies.
I'm sorry.
No, it's not you. There are discrepancies concerning the primary bullet injury, and also the evidence of additional bullet entries. The hole behind the president's right ear, and the entry hole in the back of the lower shoulder. Could you please share what was actually observed by yourself and the attending pathologists and doctors at that time?
Yes. The, quote, entry wound in the back of the head that was described in the autopsy, official autopsy report, is something I never saw. Now, I should have, because I helped place the body, move the body around and so forth, and assisting the x-ray people in doing the x-rays. The wound in, quote, in the neck actually was a wound that was down approximately 4 or 5 inches into the back itself, close to the in the media are in between the spinal cord and the shoulder blade. That wound also was moved up probably 4 to 5 inches in the autopsy report to make it adhere to the single bullet theory. When this, I mean, the autopsy report that was given to the Warren Commission, I believe, was a report to establish a conclusion of a single bullet, assassin from behind. Even though most of the evidence that we saw at autopsy did not really support that.
From your personal experience and what you've been able to examine later, what are your theories as to what actually happened? How many bullets do you feel the president was hit with, and do you believe that the kill shot was from the back or from the front?
Well, during the autopsy, I observed Dr. Fink and Dr. Humes examining a small wound just slightly forward of the right ear and slightly above the right ear. And at that point in time, Dr. Fink made a statement about this possibly could be an entrance wound, a bullet caused by a bullet. The margins of that wound were kind of gray, and he said that possibly could have been from lead from a bullet. I know that this was being examined at the time Dr. Humes was called to the gallery to talk to Dr. Berkeley. And then he came back and immediately pulled Dr. Fink away from the wound, examining the wound, and to the larger wound in the head. That wound was never returned to. There were no further examinations of that wound during the autopsy that I observed.
Okay, I appreciate your thoughts. Please hold on there. Let's now go over to our final panelist to hear his perspective on this. And he has something unique, Hugh Clark, who was the honor god to pick up the body of the president. Nice to have you with us today, Hugh.
Good to be here, Gary.
Hugh, you were there to accompany the body of President Kennedy from Andrews Air Force Base to the Bethesda Hospital morgue. And your story is the escorting the body in the casket to the morgue. You saw the body laying on the table. Photos that are public are inconsistent with what you saw. That is what has infuriated you. The photos are doctored. Could you tell us about what you experienced that day and what other honor guard soldiers also experienced and we would later have a conversation with when you met? Tell us the inconsistencies, please.
Well, you know, I was 18 years old at the time and was in the Presidential Honor Guard. And as you know, we received the president's remains at Andrews Air Force Base and took it off the elevator truck and was attempting to put the remains in the Navy ambulance to be taken to Bethesda Naval Hospital for the autopsy. And it was at that time that, as we were taking the remains off the elevator truck, that we were rushed by, you know, Secret Service, FBI, and some military personnel, one in particular, General McHugh, who was the president's aide. And at that time, we didn't find any difference in the weight of the casket, as we had carried many caskets to their final resting place at Arlington National Cemetery. However, during this, I want to say, well, for lack of a better word, the struggle for the casket to put it in the ambulance where it was almost dropped and hit the tarmac, there was no difference in the weight that we found, because I know that there had been many many discussions as to whether the president was in the casket and whether the casket was empty. I even heard some reports that they had put two oxygen tanks in the casket. However, if there had been oxygen tanks in the casket that night, because of the way the remains was being handled, there would have been a lot of clanging and clacking going on, which we did not observe. But once we got to Bethesda Naval Hospital, we arrived in a helicopter shortly before the motorcade. However, we shadowed the motorcade all the way to Bethesda Naval Hospital through the streets of Maryland and into D.C. and on to Bethesda Naval Hospital. But there came a time when we were waiting for the motorcade to arrive in front of Bethesda that we were standing out front, and as the motorcade pulled up, Jackie Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, got out of the ambulance, went into the front of the hospital, and also in the ambulance was General McHugh. But as we attempted to move to remove the remains from the ambulance, we were rushed by hundreds of photographers, and the ambulance took off. And we jumped into the back of a pickup truck, and we were chasing this ambulance around the grounds of Bethesda Naval Hospital. But we did not lose it for no longer than maybe 15 minutes when we came upon the ambulance at the back of Bethesda Naval Hospital. And we removed the remains and boarded up the ambulatory ramp, and we had to maneuver it in such a way, there were only six of us at the time, because the walkway was so narrow that we had to raise it above our waist just to get it over the railings up to the loading dock and into the building itself, where it was placed on a dolly, and we rolled it into the double doors, or the doors of the morgue, the first set of doors, into the anteroom or the cold box room where they store bodies. And at that point, we were told to leave it at the second set of doors going into the morgue. Once we did that, we stood outside the morgue where we were on guard, and there were no other caskets or anything else taking into the morgue itself until around a little after midnight, where a mahogany casket was brought into the morgue. But during the autopsy, I had an opportunity to peer into the morgue itself, where I observed the president lying on the table, and I could see from the waist up was uncovered, and it was at that time where I saw the president's neck, which was in a chalk block. But at that time, I didn't know what it was, but it stuck with me all those years. And it wasn't until I became a New York City detective and going to the morgue to observe or get fingerprints from DOAs that I asked one of the pathologists, what do you call that thing under the neck? And it was then that I learned what they called it, which was a chalk block. And I didn't really put any significance behind that until 52 years later, when I first observed the pictures that were quote-unquote supposed to be pictures of the actual autopsy. And when I observed that, I said, no, that's not what I observed. That's not there. And then when speaking with Jim and other people that worked in the morgue that night, I think Jim Jenkins will tell you that they don't even use that type of equipment at Bethesda Naval Hospital. And for me, it was very...
So please continue, Hugh. since you were not only there, you were a witness to this. This had to have been traumatic. But now as a practicing detective, someone who is experienced in investigations, tell us what you saw and what the discrepancies are.
What I observed that night, you know, as an 18-year-old, you know, was, as you said, very traumatic. And it's something that I would never forget for the simple reason it was the President of the United States. But it wasn't until we were all brought together as a group 52 years later in Chicago where we had an opportunity to sit down and talk with each other, not any pre-discussions, but the researchers asked, well, what part did you play in? As we were telling our part in the president's funeral, when we finished telling the part that we played and then listening to Jim Jenkins and Dennis David, who stated that, well, gentlemen, listen, we're not disputing what you're saying in terms of bringing the body there, but and how you brought the body in the bronze casket and all of that. They told us that, you know, now these are eyewitnesses, Gary, that, you know, 15, 20 minutes before you guys got here, a black hearse pulled up. We took a silver shipping casket out of the black hearse, brought it into the morgue and set it on the floor, removed the president's body and placed it on the table. Well, when the casket team heard that, I mean, we immediately started arguing. Number one, we would never put anybody's remains on the floor, let alone the president of the United States. But when they went on to say about the silver shipping casket, we thought that they misunderstood that it was a bronze casket, and they said, no, no, this is what we did. It was a silver shipping casket. And I have to tell you, from that point on, I mean, we were very angry. We were very angry. We felt that we had been duped. We felt that we had been betrayed. We felt that the American people were sold a bill of goods that really didn't take place. And we couldn't understand why the deception, because the president was dead, and this was supposed to be a solemn occasion. But as we went on with the story, it just seemed to get worse and worse, you know, where they told a story to try to make the story fit the evidence, which it did not do.
So, for in lay language, explain to the person listening what this actually means. Did you not carry the president? Were you not carrying the casket with the president?
Well, again, Garrett, I mean, it's, you know, from what we were told was that the president was in the bronze casket that we had taken off of the elevator truck, removed from Air Force One, placed in the Navy ambulance, which we shadowed all the way to Bethesda Naval Hospital, and at no point did that motorcade stop. So it's just inconceivable for all of us to believe that Jackie Kennedy got into a Navy ambulance and Bobby Kennedy was in the Navy ambulance in an empty casket. But at the same time, how do we then say that the president was removed from a black hearse in a silver shipping casket, taken into the morgue, placed on the floor, and removed by the staff in the morgue? Now, there's no reason for me or any of the casket team to disbelieve what Jim Jenkins or any of those guys in the morgue or say. They were eyewitnesses, just as we were eyewitnesses. And Jim will tell you that the following morning after they finished cleaning up the morgue, when they came out of the morgue, that bronze casket was pushed up against the coal boxes, and they were told, don't open that casket because it contained an Air Force colonel. So with all the deception going on, you know, if you ask me, do I know for sure that the president was in that bronze casket? Absolutely not.
Go over what you said you saw through the window into the morgue and what would later be photographs that we were told was of the autopsy.
Gary, you're breaking up a little bit. I didn't hear that question.
Explain what the difference is, Hugh, when you look through the window and you saw the president's body from the waist up, you said, and the head and the neck, and what the pictures that are out there today that are the official autopsy pictures, what was the primary difference?
Well, the difference was that the president that I saw, or the person that I saw lying on a table, his neck was, or under his neck was a chalk block. It's almost like a plastic or rubber collar that they place under the neck to raise so they're able to examine the head. All right, in the official photographs of the president's autopsy, the thing that's under the president or around are metal stirrups. It almost appears to be metal stirrups. And when I asked Jim in Chicago, I said, Jim, I said, what are these photographs or where are these photographs from? He's the one that told me, he says, we don't even use that type of equipment, or that he has never seen that type of equipment at Bethesda Naval Hospital. So clearly that said to me was that these pictures were taken someplace else. And the other part of it is they took 8 sets of x-rays, Gary, at Bethesda Naval Hospital. Everybody in law enforcement knows that when you have a bullet wound or bullet fragment, those are going to show up they're going to show up like little lights on an x-ray. None of that was present. There were no bullet fragments found in the president's, or during the president's autopsy. No fragments, no trace evidence. So where did all of that go? And I think when you talk, or when you speak with Dennis David, he will tell you that he went up because he had to type out a classified memo, that when he went upstairs to class to type out this classified memo, the person that he had to type the memo for gave him a vial with a number of fragments in a vial, and he was told these were taken from the president's autopsy. Now, Dennis David didn't know that at the time, but Jim will tell you there were no fragments removed from the president's body during the autopsy at Bethesda Naval Hospital.
Hugh, hold on there for a moment. Let's go back to Jim Jenkins in Alabama, who was in the autopsy room and helped participate as an autopsy technician. Jim, could you clarify a few of the things that Hugh said for us between what you saw there and when the president's body arrived? Did it come in a silver casket put on the ground, in which case the body was taken out from there, or did it come in a bronze casket? How did the body get into the room?
The body was brought in what we term as a shipping casket. It came into the morgue proper. Was set down on the floor by the table, and the body was removed and placed on the table or placed on the gurney. I'm not sure which at that time. I did not directly participate in removing the body from the casket, even though, because I was at the front autopsy table at that time, preparing for the autopsy to start, even though there's approximately, I would say, no more than 10 to 15 feet away from where they were moving the casket. The reason I didn't go back there, there were a lot of people there at the casket, more than I felt like needed to be there to remove the body. The other thing that Yubi was talking about were the photographs that he was mentioning. What we are doing, when I first saw these photographs, they didn't look like they came that the body was in the morgue where we did the autopsy at Bethesda. There were several things that were unusual. First of all, they were using kind of a stirrup that attached to the table to hold the head up. Now, I did autopsies in that morgue for 18 months, and at no time did we ever use anything of that nature. I'm not even sure that the table would have been able to fit in an attachment like that to it. That and some other discrepancies in the photographs have me to believe that those photographs were not taken in the morgue at night. And also the photographs that we took in the morgue at night don't seem to have disappeared or have been replaced. I am in the process of trying to be able to view the photograph. Hello?
Yes, we're listening.
Okay, I'm in the process of trying to get permission to visit the archives and review those photographs that are there that are supposedly the originals.
Well, let me summarize to see if
at this point in time.
Jim, let me summarize, Jim, you and Hugh, and see if this makes sense. Hugh is saying that the casket that he and the other naval honor guard carried into the hospital, had to lift over a bar to get it in, was a bronze casket, and they did not take it into the autopsy room. They were told to leave it outside, in which they stayed outside the room. They were told not to go in. Now we're told that there's a silver casket that the body of the president was brought into the room, put on the floor. That's completely at odds with what the actual honor guard, when they met, said. This didn't happen. And then they were told that, well, there was a different body in that. Why would there be a different body in that? Because that was the hearse that had the ambulance that had the president's body. And why would the RFK be in there and Jackie Onassis, the president's, or Jackie Kennedy, the president's wife, be there, unless they were duped, unless they didn't know? Also, we've been told by you that, and also earlier by William, that the autopsy clearly showed that had been previous, some form of previous autopsy work done on there, based upon what the original people in Dallas showed in drawings and descriptions. They did no autopsy in Dallas. They made no punctures outside of the one for the president to be able to breathe, but nothing there would have been constituted as an autopsy. Yet when you see the body, one of the physicians, the leading physician, is remarking about how gaping wounds here and much larger there, and as you said, from a few millimeters to a substantial amount of millimeters. So clearly, from your perspective and others who were witness, there someone had done something to the body. When and where, we do not know. What we can say with some certainty is that other individuals, or an individual or individuals, worked on the president's body at some point between Dallas and getting into that morgue. Photographs that supposedly represent the final autopsy photographs of the president of the United States are not the same as the ones that you personally saw, nor the ones that Hugh Clark saw through the window, nor the other Naval Honor Guard members who all saw. So when you all got together 54 years later and had a conversation, you realize something was terribly amiss. The fact that there's a different casket, bronze, a 400-pound bronze casket versus a silver casket, going into the room and putting it on the floor versus being out of the room, having a different type of brace under the neck versus, as you said, in the 18 months you worked there on multiple autopsies, no such thing, no device had ever been used. And so the idea is that clearly we should suspect that individuals who had the power, because the only people who could have had the power to do this would have been people who had the power at the national security level, like the head of the FBI, head of the CIA, people who are on the inside circle of the president, because they're the only ones who could have kept anyone else from investigating or finding this evidence. A lone person could not have done this. They could not have had access to the body. They could not have made these, try to make it look like it was a single bullet. Also, we've heard that the bullet entry wound that all of us saw in the Zapruder film, including Robert Morningstar, who I'm sure many of you know Robert. Robert believes that it was Tippett who was the photograph in the doctored photographs. True or not, it's worth considering and at least looking at the evidence. But it's the head front shot, which would have been the grassy knoll, that caused the president's head to recoil back. We're supposed to believe that that didn't happen, that there was only that bullet from the back. It's simply physiological impossible for a bullet to have gone in the directions, trajectory it went, end up completely whole, and have done all that, including to Governor Connally, and then be found by the FBI in the car. So there are just too many inconsistencies and discrepancies for us not to be concerned that this was a setup and we've been lied to, and you've come forward. Now let's go back originally to William Mattson Law. And William, with what we've said, please add in anything that could give us better insights into this, since you're the one who interviewed two of the original FBI agents who were in the morgue who said this wasn't a single bullet.
Okay. Well, the FBI agents, Seibert had told me at one point, I asked him about the brain. When I first came to Florida to interview him, there's been controversy about whether there was a brain in the head or not. Paul O'Connor had for years, who was Jim Jenkins' partner in the morgue that night, said that there was no brain to be removed. Although Jim has said that he was given a brain to infuse. I wanted to ask the FBI agent Seibert whether or not there was a brain within the cranium. And as I climbed into his car, he was taking me to his home. His wife was sitting in the front seat with him, and I was in the back, along with a friend of mine, Deborah Conway, who I had taken along, that had a lot of documents we were going to go through. And on the way there, I thought, how am I going to ask this man if there was a brain in the president's head? At which point, I said something along the lines of, Mr. Seibert, I'm so glad that I'm here with you because you actually saw the body and you can tell us so much. And his wife, who was sitting beside him, turned around to me and said, well, you know, his brains were all blown out of his head. Well, she had just given confirmation that when Seibert saw the body, he saw no brain within the cranium. His partner, Francis X. O'Neill, when I asked him about the brain, he got angry and he said, you keep saying brain, brain. He said there was a good portion of brain in there. I think the brain tells us a lot about the fact that there has been shenanigans, because when the Records Review Board interviewed John Stringer, he said that he took photographs of the brain. They were mostly from the superior view, meaning the top of the brain, and the sections that we have, or the pictures that we have in the archives today, almost half of those are views from the bottom. And he said, I took no pictures of the bottom of the brain. And he said these pictures are on a different kind of film than I used. So I believe that, again, says that at some point the body had been gotten to, and a lot of the evidence that we have, the so-called original copies, have been replaced or phony. There's just a myriad of things we could get into. We could speak about this for hours, and I literally have. But we're short on time here.
That's all right. I'd like for you to take your time, because this is important for a lot of people listening, and they're listening, remember, all over the world, not just in New York City. So please take us through the most compelling pieces of hard prima facie evidence that the body was either moved, that the body that they autopsied in Washington, D.C. had already been autopsied or in some way surgically changed to support a lone gunman single bullet theory. And the especially interesting to me is how they would have possibly gotten the president's body out of Dallas onto a plane, and with the first lady there, with his brother and others, without someone noticing these changes, because that would have been a heavily guarded casket. Your thoughts on any of those, please?
Well, there is a theory that's put forward by David Lifton, who wrote a book called Best Evidence. Now, as it goes with him, the casket, after it had been loaded onto the plane at some point, probably before the swearing-in began, the body was taken out of the casket and placed into a baggage compartment aboard the plane. Now, I know this sounds crazy, but the more you follow this evidence, it's about the only way that it could happen. It had to have been done at some point before either the ambulance reached the Bethesda Naval Hospital, or it happened in the hospital itself. I tend to believe that it happened inside the morgue itself, because I think that Humes and Boswell were given a scenario and told that, you know, this could lead to World War III. And so they had to go along with this. They knew about the alteration in the different caskets. And the reason, if you go back and you read their differing testimonies before differing governmental bodies, they can never seem to keep the story straight. At one point, they moved the wound up from being in the hairline to almost the top of the head above the occipital protuberance. There's a photograph number 8, that's called the mystery photo, that just shows the scalp reflected in this big, massive hole in the back of the skull. When they were shown that, they couldn't orientate it right. It's a very hard picture to make sense of. When Humes was questioned before the Records Review Board, he was questioned about why he burned his autopsy notes and his first signed draft of the autopsy report, and he was very defensive when he was asked about this, saying, "I don't know. There might have been blood on it or something like that, but." Nobody else did it. It was me. It was my decision. There's just all kinds of things. Boswell, who I believe was not part of the original plan here, got duped in that he had been taking notes himself, and his notes were later disappeared. He could not find them, and so the notes that he had to reconstitute them from his own memory. This whole case, if it is so straightforward that Lee Harvey Oswald, from a building, shot a man in a car, then why doesn't any of the evidence add up? It just doesn't add up from Dallas to Bethesda or anything in between. It's a very convoluted, twisted thing. But what we have are patterns, and we have pieces of the puzzle. They are sometimes hard to put together, to say the least.
All right, for final comments, any additional things you would like to say, Jim Jenkins, and then after that, Hugh Clark. Jim, you first.
Well, William and I disagree on one point that he mentioned. I received the information that the president had been shot in Dallas approximately around 3:30. I was a student there in the medical school laboratory and blood banking sciences. at about 3:30, we were notified that the president had been shot, and the duty section, which was myself and Paul O'Connor, were told to go to the morgue. We went to the morgue. We probably arrived in the morgue sometime between 3:30 and 4 o'clock. We began to prepare in case the body was to be brought to us. I never left the morgue that night. I was there from approximately 4 o'clock that night to 9 o'clock following the morning. So there's absolutely no way that I can justify that what happened to the body prior to Bethesda was done in our morgue at that during that period of time. It's just not possible. Now, what I do say is that the wound in the head when we received it at Bethesda was what I determined it as destined, because the actual wound itself, well, I determined by the amount of skull that was missing, bone that was missing. But the actual deficit itself was large enough that it could have been opened up, the brain could have been removed, examined for fragments and so forth, and replaced in the brain. There are others who say that there was a second brain. There's also evidence that they may be possibly correct. That this evidence is a physical difference and so forth that I observed at the autopsy. It's too extensive to get into it in the time that we have. But I believe at this point in time that possibly the brain that I handled and put in the gauze sling over the bucket to infuse may have been a brain that was substituted. Again, too, I would say that Paul says that he saw no brain whatsoever. That may be due to a timeline. The brain may have been already removed at the time, and that the brain that we removed that was given by Dr. Humes to Dr. Boswell, which subsequently was handed to me to put in the bucket, was damaged on the right and posterior portion of the brain, but the damage didn't seem to correlate with the damage to the skull. And consequently, there are other abnormal things to that brain that I observed, and they're just too lengthy to describe at this point in time. And why I feel that the brain may not have been the president's brain originally, this I can, like I said, I would need much more time to explain why I believe that. But the other thing I would like to go over here now before we leave is that Hubie's description of the casket that came in, the casket that the body arrived in was a kind of a silver gray, I guess, transport casket. Now, that casket was brought in quite some time before the honor guard brought the bronze casket in. And this casket was delivered somewhere between 6:38, 6:40, and in the afternoon. Now, I'm using other people's timelines because as I was occupied in the laboratory and it was rather intense being in there, I did not look at clocks or really know about what time these sequences occurred. But I do know that casket that was brought in by Hubert and the other honor guard was placed in the coal room, the answer, and it was pushed up against the coal boxes. I was told by a first-class hospital colonel who was the duty officer, or duty NCO for the laboratory that was with Paul and I at the time preparing, that that was a Air Force major that had arrived too late to go to Arlington, that was to be buried in Arlington on Monday, and that we were going to hold the casket in our morgue until Monday, and it would be picked up. That was a very unusual thing. I never saw that occur again during the time that I was at Bethesda. Now, the other unusual thing of this is that that casket in the morning, about around 6 o'clock when I went up to check the logbook and so forth, was gone. So it was not being held for burial in Arlington. I was told directly that we were not to open that casket, and it was, and I really didn't pay much attention to it after that. The casket that we put the body in around 3-4 o'clock in the morning, or sometime between midnight and 3, was the mahogany casket that I later learned had been brought from Gawler's funeral home for the president's body to be placed in, because the original bronze casket had a broken handle. As far as I can determine, I believe that the casket, the bronze casket that Hubie and the honor guard brought in, was empty, or maybe it did, it had been weighted. I don't know of that. But I feel like that casket was empty, and because by the time that casket arrived at the morgue door, the body was on the table, and we had already proceeded to begin the autopsy.
Well, that clearly shows, Jim, that clearly shows there were two caskets that arrived, and it also shows that the honor guard had taken the casket out of the ambulance, the same ambulance that the president's wife and brother had exited. Now, they would not have been in an ambulance with a casket that was empty or not their brother's unless someone had changed it on the airplane or after exiting the airplane. And then the fact that you were lied to and told, well, don't open the casket. It's going to go to Arlington and it'll be taken on Monday. If it was going to be taken on Monday, what is the probability that someone would have taken it in the early hours of a morning? Highly improbable. So too many inconsistencies to realize this.
Yeah. The further question there is, what happened to the shipping casket that the body was brought in? It was also taken by Gawler's that morning when they brought the mahogany casket in. Now, I don't really like to speculate what occurred outside the laboratory. I've been in a laboratory all my life, outside the morgue, because the only thing that I really but the only thing that I really can say that happened that night in the autopsy was actually what occurred in the autopsy that I participated in. And everything outside this is speculation on my part, and I really, really wouldn't want to get into that speculation.
Okay.
I do know that, and I can't say that the casket that that Honegard brought in was definitely empty because I was told not to look in that, and not to open it, and I was in the military, and I followed the orders that I was given.
Jim so, Jenkins, thank you very much.
I do know the body was taken out of a separate casket. We usually term the shipping casket.
Okay. Final quick comment, yeah, Hugh Clark.
Okay, Gare, there's a couple of things. One of the things that I should have mentioned was the aide to President Kennedy from the Air Force was General McHugh. And one of the things that happened while we were trying to remove the casket or the remains off the elevator truck, we were jostled. We were rushed by a number of people in civilian clothes and General McHugh. Now, one of the things that also took place on Air Force One, which we found out when we were at the morgue, was that President Johnson was very insistent on having Jackie Kennedy come up and witness his swearing in. Because, what we were told was that Jackie or Mrs. Kennedy was back sitting with the bronze casket of her husband, and that she was summoned by, President Johnson to come up and witness the swearing in. And this was told to us by General McHugh because he was very upset at the fact that she was summoned to come up and witness the swearing in. And also, the other thing that was unusual is that, everybody at Andrews Air Force Base knew, or they could see us, that we were the Honor Guard that was commanded by Major General Wheel, who was in charge of the Military District of Washington. And they know, they know what protocol is. But with my suspicious mind is that they didn't want anybody else to handle that casket other than the people that, were jostling us. It just appeared, looking back, that they didn't want anybody else to handle that casket. Now, I know Will had said that there's a possibility that the body was removed while they were on Air Force One, and that is a possibility, all right? The other thing that you mentioned was when you look at the president's motorcade, and I have to tell you that I was in Dallas this past November, and for the first time, and when I went out to see where the president's motorcade was and where the book depository was and where the grassy knoll was, and having done many investigations with gunshot wounds, along with, other shootings. And I looked and I tried to imagine how this could have happened with this one bullet, and he was the lone shooter. It was just impossible. It's just impossible. When you see the first shot, the president grabs his throat. And as he's moving forward, you see the headshot. You see the headshot? I mean, just as clear as day. And for me, as an investigator and looking at these things, it is no way possible that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone shooter, that there was one shot, that this magical bullet, and I mean, it just doesn't make sense. And for me, as an investigator, it just appears that they tried to mold this story to fit their evidence.
Well, they've done a pretty good job because the mainstream media...
No, because you know, Gary, I just want you to think about this for a second. They did it at a time where the country was grieving, the country was distraught, it was the government telling us what happened. And for 52 years, I believed it. I never watched it on TV. I never wanted to hear anybody else's account of what took place because I believed the government, as well as many Americans did, because they were grieving and they wanted to believe that this individual, this loner, this drifter, this lowlife guy killed the president of the United States. The evidence, if we had really looked at it then, did not support this story.
You're absolutely correct.
And as a person that has been in the military, as a person that has had five family members, five brothers and sisters that have served in the military, we all felt betrayed.
Well, fellas, it is. That's why we're doing this program, to try to get more pieces of the puzzle out. Jim Jenkins, Hugh Clark, William Mattson Lowell, thank you all very much. You have all added substantially to our insights, because you were all first-person witnesses, or interviewed people who were first-person witnesses, and this helps us better understand how we were betrayed, how they got away with it, and we will continue. Thank you all very much. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening.
As long as we've been together, that should be so easy.